Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, and Justice Ridgely. This is the appeal of M3 Healthcare Solution from the Court of Chancery grant of summary judgment in favor of Family Practice Associates. With permission from the court, I will refer to the appellant as M3 and the appellee as FPA throughout this argument. The arbitration at issue in this case was awarded on March 24, 2009. The underlying dispute between the parties concerned a billing services agreement entered into between FPA, a medical practice, and M3, a medical billing company. The dispute concerned thousands of individual billing instances, each alleged by FPA to have been a breach of the billing services agreement. The arbitrator's decision was based on a sampling of the billing disputes. The arbitration hearing went on for 5 days over about a one-year period. By agreement between the parties, the arbitration was conducted by a single private arbitrator and governed by the American Arbitration Association rules. The arbitrator's award was in favor of FPA for $60,457.32, and additionally provided for an award of interest from June 30, 2006. The award also assessed the cost of arbitration against M3. FPA filed a complaint to confirm the arbitration award on April 7, 2009, and an amended complaint on April 23, 2009. M3 filed an answer on May 15, 2009.
There's no question then that the answer was filed within 90 days of the award?
No, Your Honor. It was filed within the 90 days.
And what did the answer contain?
The answer contained affirmative defenses to the confirmation of the arbitration award. First, that the award of arbitrator's fees was improperly assessed against M3. Second, that the award of interest should have been calculated from the date of the award and not the date of the breach. Third, that the Chancery Court complaint was not properly verified. And fourth, that the award should be vacated based upon the arbitrator's failure to consider material evidence. On July 31, 2009, FPA filed a motion for summary judgment. In that motion, FPA argued that it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law based upon M3's failure to present timely grounds for modifying or vacating the award under the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act.
Now, on the affirmative defense, there was no follow-up motion of any kind? I'm thinking by analogy in action at law, there may be a first affirmative defense. The complaint fails to state a cause of action under 12b-6. But isn't there usually in that circumstance a motion to bring it to the attention of the court?
Yes, I see your point entirely, but there was not a motion filed. This case, it was simply put in the affirmative defenses, and there was not a follow-up action. Essentially not until after FPA filed their motion, so they were the ones to bring it to the attention of the court. FPA's opening brief argued that because we put them in affirmative defenses and did not file a motion, that it was an untimely application those affirmative defenses were untimely as they were not brought by motion.
Well, historically, the law draws the distinction between defending something and asking for affirmative relief. For example, if your opponent takes an appeal, you can simply, if you're the appellee, defend the judgment. But if you want affirmative relief, you have to file a cross appeal. So in this case, while the affirmative defenses were filed, how does your client get affirmative relief? Just to follow up on what Justice Ridgely said, isn't there normally a second step?
Yes, and I think that in this case, the only remedy would be for, as we are now outside, if we were to be remanded back to the lower court, we now are outside the 90-day period for filing a motion. However, I would suggest that the filing of the affirmative defense has preserved M3's right to file a nunk-pro-tunk motion out of time to bring these grounds before the court.
The arbitration Act refers to an application. Is there case law defining what an application means?
There is not case law defining what an application means. under the Uniform Act, there is a comment that reads, off the top of my head, that an application is used throughout the Uniform Act, and it was bracketed in the Act as if it was not meant to circumvent the local rules of any state which adopted the Act as far as what an application was defined as. And I do cite some cases in the opening brief that were from other states interpreting similar uniform acts where they accepted applications which were made in responsive pleadings and responsive and not made by motion before the court.
Well, anywhere in your affirmative defense, the two points you mentioned are that the costs should not have been assessed, and the interest rate started on the wrong day. Did your client ever say, please correct both of those?
I don't think that the client ever instructed us. I'm sure that they reviewed the answer to the complaint at the time that it was filed.
Not technically, but if I read all of this, and I have, where do I see is something that says the arbitrator got it wrong, and here's what you should do? You don't read that anywhere, do you?
No, other than in the affirmative defenses. And I think that the sticking point for me is that the affirmative defenses, if not raised, are waived. So what if they meant nothing? Then what does that preserve?
One of the options that you would have, put aside for a moment whether it's by motion or by other form of pleading, one of the options you have is to ask the court to modify the award. Is there anything in the Act that says the exclusive way of asking for modification is by a motion independent of a complaint filed to confirm the award?
I do not believe there's anything in the Act along those lines.
Now, if the court addressed both the complaint to conform the award and your affirmative defenses, it's necessary for the court to address the merit of your affirmative defenses in the context of whether, if they're valid, they would modify the award, correct?
Correct. And in this case, I think, as FPA brought a motion for summary judgment, to confirm the award, that under Rule 56, which governs the court's discretion in considering a motion for summary judgment, it is required to consider the entire record in determining whether or not there is a material fact. And for that reason as well, FPA's chosen method of bringing the confirmation to the court's attention, I think, also compelled the lower court to consider the grounds, to reach the grounds in the affirmative defenses, although not brought by motion.
As I understand the proceedings, in the motion for summary judgment, it was more than you haven't filed a motion within 90 days to modify or vacate the award. It also addressed the merits of your affirmative defenses, didn't it?
I would disagree with that. I believe that that motion did not reach the merits of our grounds, not in any substantive way.
All right. We'll accept the fact that I was trying to be helpful and ask it in another way. When the court addressed the motion for summary judgment, the court also addressed the merits of your affirmative defenses, didn't it?
Yes.
Having done that, is there any question about whether FPA was on notice about the merits of your request by affirmative defense to modify or vacate the award?
I think that FPA was on notice from them being contained in our affirmative defenses, and they were also, those grounds were briefed in our opening brief on appeal, and
regardless of the merit of why you wanted it modified or vacated in part, FPA had to know from the very moment you filed your answer that questions would be raised about whether their award should be confirmed as is or whether it would be confirmed with modification, correct?
Correct.
Right. Well, if you look at the Court of Chancery's bench ruling, it seems to have decided the case based on alternative grounds, putting aside what application means and whether you properly raised this in your affirmative defenses. It said, let's assume I'm wrong on that. Let's go to the merits.
Okay.
And in looking at your affirmative defenses, the Court of Chancery just will pick three things. It said, I don't see any problem with the court awarding fees because we had this dispute about confidentiality agreements, and it seems to me that there wasn't really a meeting of the minds and that no one refused to settle in good faith. Your position is we primarily prevailed, even though the award was against us, for $60,000 because they wanted $180,000, and the court rejected that on the merits. And then just to pick the last point, the question was, well, when we had this rebuttal witness, they didn't bring in the Blue Cross and Blue Shield papers, and therefore that was material evidence, and that Court of Chancery got it wrong. And the Court of Chancery's position was this was a rebuttal witness, not a primary witness. This was arbitration. So pick any or all of those. Where did the Court of Chancery err, commit reversible error on the merits?
I would say for all three, and I can explain why. For the assessment of pre-judgment interest and the cost of arbitration against IM3, I believe that the trial court erred because FPA was not the prevailing party at the end of the arbitration, and therefore pre-judgment interest and arbitration costs were not appropriately assessed against M3. The purpose of a prejudgment, an award of prejudgment interest, is to compensate the prevailing party for the loss of income it would have earned had the judgment been paid earlier. And the determination of the prevailing party is not necessarily the party who was ultimately awarded damages in the judgment. And it is also an equitable consideration where the court has discretion to consider the actions of the parties in determining. And I believe that because FPA's initial arbitration demand was for $168,602.59, they were only ultimately awarded 36% of that initial demand.
I take it in this proceeding there's no offer of judgment process.
There was not.
Your client took the position, I take it from the beginning, that FPA was entitled to zero.
We did take the position there was sort of two breaches that were claimed by FBA. One was that we repudiated the contract, and therefore they were entitled to costs for mediating our breach. The other part of that was the individual billing instances, and there were some billing instances in which M3 admitted that they had failed, as FPA alleged, on those breaches. However, there were several that were disputed and several that FPA conceded was not the fault of M3.
But doesn't the record reflect there was an offer of $80,000?
Yes. There was a negotiation process which was begun by FPA, and this was, I believe, after the hearings had already started to proceed. And their initial demand included a non-disclosure confidentiality clause, and it was FPA who indicated this would be included in any settlement agreement that was reached. And that is partially our understanding from settling cases prior to this, where that was not a term that would change after the initial demand was made by a party.
I'm just talking about the money. There was an award in the $60,000, mm-hmm.
Yes.
There had been an offer of $80,000.
I think it was $85,000, actually, was the final offer, and that was where settlement negotiations ultimately broke down, because FPA then indicated for the first time that they would no longer accept the non-disclosure confidentiality term, which unfortunately was not something that M3 had been aware of ahead of time in all the times that they had gone back and gotten more authority and come up with another counteroffer, and also was not something that they could unfortunately accept in the settlement agreement. And actually, my understanding that is that FPA actually in defining the payment for that term almost reverted back virtually to their initial arbitration demand amount.
Is it accurate to say that every dollar awarded by the arbitrator was resisted, an award of that dollar was resisted at the arbitration hearing itself, apart from the settlement discussions?
Yes. It was the position of M3. Well, no, not every dollar. Like I said, there were some that were conceded, some individual billing instances that were conceded by M3. However, the bulk of the damages requested by FPA was due to mitigation issues that we completely disagreed with. And from the
well, is there in the record somewhere then a concession to the arbitrator? We consent to an award of X.
No, no, that was not the case. It was simply individual billing instances wherein M3 said on those occasions we did fail to timely submit a claim, and we basically admitted that we were at fault in those instances. But it was out of the sampling, so it was an even smaller amount than the total. And I think it was in the single digits as far as how many we actually said okay we admit. But there was never a dollar amount based on that concession ever presented.
So was there anything said or done at the hearing which would have eliminated the need for FPA to have a lawyer there pressing its position forward?
No, I don't believe so. To continue on our basis on the merits, we also believe that there was a ground for vacating the arbitration award, which was in our affirmative defenses, based on the arbitrator's failure to consider material evidence. An award is properly vacated where the arbitrator's failure to consider material evidence, quote, so affects the rights of the parties that it may be said that he was deprived of a fair hearing.
Well, if I understood your recitation of the facts correctly, this arbitration took place for a total of 5 days, but the 5 days were over the course of a year?
Yes.
Well, when we got to the point in this particular proceeding and the Blue Cross materials weren't available, if they'd already spread this out for a year, why didn't they just stop and get the materials and pick up from there?
That is a good question. Because the arbitration hearing was not recorded, I'm operating under the recollection of counsel who was present at the arbitration hearing, and the understanding was that those documents were requested, however, they were never received, and unfortunately I don't have a specific record as far as what exactly happened. And I don't think anybody really knows. It's just the recollection of the parties who were present.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Curtis Crowther on behalf of Family Practice Associates. Your Honor, the first rule of arbitration is that the Court of Chancery is not supposed to get into the merits of the arbitration issues themselves, but rather it's supposed to sit to make sure that procedural due process and procedural rules were followed so that someone's rights weren't wholly violated at the arbitration process. That is something that M3 has never alleged, not in any motion, not in any application, and certainly not in its affirmative defenses here. As this Court noted, the merits of the affirmative defenses do not get to the level necessary to either vacate, modify, or correct an award in arbitration.
When did we note that?
I'm sorry?
When did we note that?
In the question that the Court of Chancery found that they did not. I think Justice Holland asked the question.
Well, we always distinguish between asking questions and noting something. So we haven't noted anything yet. We're just trying to understand the case.
I understand, Your Honors. In this situation, M3 did not file any application, motion, or complaint to modify, correct, or vacate the arbitration award.
What does the phrase move, answer, or otherwise plead mean to you?
In the context of Rule 12, Your Honor?
In the context of 21st century notice pleading as opposed to 19th century technical pleading?
That gives three options: to move, which follows a motion, to answer, file an answer, to plead, we file some other pleading that's provided for by the rules, such as a reply or some other pleading that may be by the specific state rules or other rules that may govern the proceedings. In this case, and the statute specifically provides, that it must be by complaint or application. The idea of moving, pleading, or filing defenses is not provided for by the statute. Rather, it specifically says that you must file a complaint or application.
Well, in this case, let's take an example. Your client wants the award confirmed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And let's suppose that the Court of Chancery was having a hearing and it was going to act on your request for confirmation. The affirmative defense, just to pick one, says you can't confirm what was done because the interest rate starts on the wrong date. What would your response be to the court?
It would be twofold. It would be actually threefold. One is that is procedurally insufficient to modify or correct the award because the statute specifically requires that a party seek that affirmatively by application or complaint.
All right, let's stop on number one for a minute. Are you suggesting that when the affirmative defense makes the point, let's assume for the moment that it's meritorious, that the award itself is incorrect, but simply because the party doesn't raise that by separate motion, but asserts it in a pleading as an affirmative defense, that the court's obligation is to ignore the fact that the award was incorrect?
The court's obligation under the statutory scheme is to confirm the award unless certain events have occurred prior to the confirmation. And those events require an application or a complaint seeking to modify, correct, or vacate that award. If that has not happened, the court is obligated, mandated by statute, to confirm that award.
Well, isn't that an implicit application? Your Honor, the numbers are wrong, the dates are wrong. Don't do it. And what's left out other than the word?
An affirmative act. That's what's left out. That is what the statute requires, an affirmative act.
So a counterclaim would suffice?
No. An application would require a motion because procedurally, the only way to get the court to do something in the Court of Chancery in this proceeding is to file a motion. Because the complaint to confirm the arbitration, which is the complaint required by the statute, is filed, the only way for the court to get the other matters before it is by a motion.
Doesn't it strike you as somewhat anomalous that the jurisdiction is put in a court of equity and the issue you're raising right now is right out of Dickens in the sense that it's highly technical, doesn't allow the court of equity to address the merits of an issue that's actually raised and an issue about which the other party's on notice and really calls upon the court to enter an incorrect judgment?
Well, one, Your Honor, Delaware actually does not only vest the Court of Chancery with this jurisdiction, but also the Court of Common Pleas in consumer cases. The Court of Common Pleas, of course, is not a court of equity. So to say that it's the Court of Equity should be doing just equity, well, in Delaware, that's actually divided into two different courts, one sitting in law and one sitting in equity. The only difference being the Court of Common Pleas is only governed by with consumer arbitrations.
And this isn't a consumer arbitration?
It is not. If the statutory scheme was to allow a party to simply sit back and wait and do nothing, the legislature could have achieved that result in the drafting of the statute. It did not.
And we don't have those facts here. It's not a party that did nothing. It's a party that pleaded in an answer affirmative defenses which examined on their merits, address whether or not the award that you've asked to have confirmed should be modified as a result of error by the arbitrator.
We disagree, Your Honor, that that is sufficient procedurally under the statutory scheme.
No, make. I understand that, but you said the party did nothing. The facts show that the party filed an answer and asserted affirmative defenses which are consistent, if examined on the merits, with a request for a modification, an alteration, a correction, or a vacation in part of the award, even though it wasn't by a separate motion.
We would disagree that they were, in fact, sufficient under the statutory scheme to either.
No, I understand that, but you do agree with me that it's not a party who did nothing.
Under the statute, yeah, they certainly filed a document.
They certainly put you on notice of what their problem was with the award you wanted confirmed.
They filed an answer to a complaint alleging affirmative defenses as set forth in their brief.
And those affirmative defenses put you on notice about their concern about the correctness of the arbitration award, correct?
They filed a pleading. This isn't a notice issue. This is a statutory scheme that must be complied with. Otherwise, the court is mandated to confirm the arbitration award.
Well, I guess we'll find out whether it's a notice issue, won't we?
Well, and as we saw when your opponent was arguing, sometimes the court asks friendly questions. So I'm going to give you that heads up before I ask this question. As I understand what you're saying is, it's similar to raising the statute of limitations as an affirmative defense. And you put your opponent on notice that you think there's a problem with the statute of limitations. But generally, you have to follow up with a motion for summary judgment asserting that the claim is barred by the statute of limitations. It's not simply enough to say the court can't grant relief because the statute of limitations is a bar. You have to do something once you've given notice that the statute of limitations is an issue. Is that correct?
Yes and no, actually. It is yes because if you don't file a dispositive motion before the bar date for filing dispositive motions, the court may view that as being waived subsequent to its being preserved in the affirmative defense. So, yes, it very much is akin to the same situation. However, in this case, our view is that it's not even preserved, that it's not as fact that you, if you don't plead it in an answer, it's not preserved. It doesn't matter. You must make an affirmative application. So this is one step further than that. Not only did you blow the bar date for dispositive motions, but you blew the bar date for raising objections. And that is by statute. That is 90 days. If you don't do something within that 90-day period, you've blown the bar date. You are now precluded. You are now waived.
But something was done. The argument is over whether it's sufficient.
Yes. Procedurally, whether it's sufficient is the first part of the argument. Of course, we will also get into the merits of the defenses raised, and I would like to address that if I may.
Before you do, did you find it at all interesting that the Vice Chancellor didn't end the case on your first argument but decided to also address the merits of the affirmative defenses as they applied to modification or vacation or correction of the arbitration award?
I prefer the alternative grounds myself, Your Honor. I thought that that was an appropriate way of conducting the hearing so that at least they got out what they wanted to get out, they were heard, and ultimately the court disagreed on the merits of their arguments. I certainly, when I'm on the winning side, I don't mind having a bulletproof decision. And I think in this case, it was essentially a bulletproof decision. Because on the merits.
Well, let's start with the rebuttal witness on the merits.
Sure.
Especially in the context of an arbitration that takes place during the course of a year, over 5 days. Obviously, the rebuttal witness was deemed to be important, and the witness's testimony was based on these papers, you know, the internal documents from Blue Cross. I realize that there appears to have been a request, and the Vice Chancellor in his oral ruling said, you know, if you request something and you don't get it, and you don't make a motion to compel, when the witness testifies, to the extent you think it's important, that's unfortunate for you because you didn't avail yourself of the proper procedures. So why was the court correct on that? Because it was not material, because the person had slept on their rights, for want of a better term, or both?
Actually, factually, there was no request for an adjournment of the hearing at all. That was admitted at the argument in the Court of Chancery. That is what the statute would have provided grounds for vacating or modifying the award, perhaps. It was never made. We did not ask the witness in the rebuttal about a written policy. We asked him specifically about whether or not certain things the other side said were sufficient were. He was the manager of the department who made those decisions. He said no, absolutely not, contrary to the argument that M3 had made throughout the arbitration. There was no request for any documents unless they were made to the witness, but the witness did not have them. They could have subpoenaed a witness. They had that power. They did not. They could have done a lot of things and did not. But whether their procedural rights were violated is a whole different story here. And they were not. They continued with the arbitration. They cross-examined the witness. I was there. In fact, he tried to get the policy electronically, but could not because the system was sealed off. The arbitration concluded. The arbitrator then, after briefing, made his decision. There's no procedural due process violations here. There was no request to adjourn the hearing. There was no request for an additional day of hearing. This procedure went on for a year of arbitration. They could have done a lot and chose not to. And that, as we indicated in our brief, you cannot ask a court of chancery in confirming an arbitration award to correct what counsel should have done or may have done. We don't think it would have been successful, but he never even asked for an adjournment of the hearing, and that would have been the remedy.
Is it customary at these hearings that there's no record of anything?
That was agreed by counsel not to do that. We were asked whether or not we wanted to have a reporter there. I have to tell you, this was a very unorthodox arbitration. Because of the nature of the charges, it was done essentially in a group setting where there was open discussion as to the individual claims that were being reviewed. It was an agreed process. It was a very smooth process. And the arbitrator made his decision accordingly. Neither party chose to have a court reporter present, and they were offered that opportunity.
And you described the process as smoothly unorthodox. That's intriguing. You often hear that alternative dispute resolution is more efficient and less expensive than trial. Is it correct that 5 separate days over the period of a year is what it took to have this arbitration completed?
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest that the time period was as good as a trial in a court was. However, there were approximately 3,000 claims involved. If we had to try each individual claim, we would have been there for months. It would have been a 3-month trial. So 5 days of trial would have been probably consecutive for the most part. But 5 days of arbitration because of schedules and availability of both the parties and the witnesses resulted in a very lengthening process. It was not a very pleasant situation. I certainly did not like that. However, the alternative would have been a 90-day trial, probably. And that would have been hugely expensive and probably impossible. The other issues raised by M3 were also rejected by the Court of Chancery in its examination of those reasons to change the arbitration or not confirm it. As the Vice Chancellor kept saying, where's your game? What do you have here? And they had nothing. The idea of the fees, it's not attorney's fees we're talking about. It's arbitrator fees. Arbitrator fees by the AAA rules, which the appellant agrees applied, are at the discretion of the arbitrator. Here, they want an appellate court, essentially, to revisit the issue of that award and say, well, you shouldn't apply them to FPA. After the fact, you should reassess the merits of that claim and apply them differently. The arbitrator heard all the evidence. The arbitrator heard all the arguments. The arbitrator made that decision. And under the AAA rules, it's entirely within the arbitrator's discretion. The Court of Chancery refused and actually said, I see no abuse of discretion from that arbitrator. There's nothing here. You've put forth nothing. Even though I'm giving you the opportunity, you have put forth nothing to warrant that. In the cases cited by M3, they refer to arbitration attorney's fees, and there are special statutory schemes with respect to attorney's fees. This is not attorney's fees. This is merely the arbitration costs, and they were high. 5 days of arbitration are not cheap. The interest is the same thing.
They're asking the Court of Chancery to revisit when interest should apply. Why? Because they don't agree with it. That's not sufficient. That's asking the Court of Chancery to do the very thing that 5701 says not to do, and that is reassess the merits of the dispute. The arbitrator already did that. The parties were required to arbitrate.
I thought that the issue on interest was with the date on which it began, not whether there should be interest or not.
That is correct, and that is a decision the arbitrator made under the rules that the arbitrator has absolute discretion to do, and that is apply interest.
What if the arbitrator gets the date wrong? The claim didn't even exist on the date he picks. Are you saying the Court of Chancery can't take a look at that to see whether or not it's correct?
That would be a decision that affects the merits of the dispute. The remedy of an arbitration is to seek clarification or modification by the arbitrator that you made a mistake. The Court of Chancery is not supposed to be an appellate court revisiting every decision that's made. If that were the case, we'd simply have arbitrations and then trials in the Court of Chancery again. That's not what the system is designed for. The ADR system is designed to be that parties are waiving their rights to have a judge.
Well, the opposite of a proper exercise of discretion is arbitrariness and capriciousness, right?
That's correct.
Are you suggesting that when someone makes an application in whatever form to modify an arbitration award, that the court can't address whether or not an element of that award was arbitrary?
They can, Your Honor, and that's a manifest disregard for the law standard. And in that case, it could be brought to the Court of Chancery's attention in order to not get to vacate the award. And that is a very high standard, and not one that M3 has even alleged to have existed. They simply disagree. They don't allege it's illegal or improper. They say you picked the wrong date. That is not sufficient. As the Court of Chancery found, none of the arguments advanced by M3 met the standards of the statute, even if they were deemed to be timely, even if they were deemed to be procedurally proper, and those decisions are sound and correct. And I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For some of my final comments, I wanted to point out that the lower court did not simply accept our affirmative defenses, M3's affirmative defenses, in making its decision on the merits. It did rule that by bringing affirmative defenses, it was an improper application under the statute, and it actually went further to state, with regard to affirmative defenses, that, quote, in my experience, that is not bringing anything before the court. So it's not a situation where the court reached the merits despite an improper application or presentment to the court. It did indeed rule that it was not an effective way by bringing affirmative defenses. And to discuss the merits just a little bit more, the testimony of Mr. Kirchhoff, I believe that the question is whether the documents we were requesting were material. And I would suggest that they are material, because this was a situation where throughout the entire arbitration, employees of M3 continued to testify and explain that the damages for the individual instances of alleged untimely claim submissions or follow-up, they had done this before. They had been able to, even though it may appear to be outside the claim period, they were able to go back to the companies and get the money later. And what Mr. Kirchhoff came in and said was, oh, no, that never happens. And without the documents in which apparently these policies were written down, we had no way of verifying whether or not, indeed, that was what occurred. And it went against all of our evidence.
Mr. Crowther says, once that problem surfaced, you didn't ask for an adjournment to get the documents. Is that correct?
That's correct. Unfortunately, there is not a record for me to have read to know exactly what happened, but I will agree with the court. I do not believe that occurred. If there's no other questions.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll
Thank
take
you.
The case under advisement and recess.
Aye.